everyone, and welcome to The Matchup, a storytelling podcast from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where you, the listener, gets to decide who told the most compelling story. I'm your host, Jason Franklin, and today, returning for another episode, we have the Reverend Lucy Strandlin. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Jason.
How are you feeling today?
I feel great.
That's good.
I'm all warmed up.
Yeah.
Got to record an episode 2 days ago. We had Ash Wednesday yesterday.
Yeah.
Back at the podcast today. Feel great.
Not tired at all.
Nope.
I feel like your job for the second part of this season has become welcoming new guests to the show.
Mm.
Because the last episode we recorded, you introduced your husband, who
sort of cruel of you, Jason, for their first episode to be against me.
Like, hey, I do my best to work out the schedule.
Nobody wants to do a second time with Lucy. Is that the problem?
Maybe that's what it is.
Because they're scared.
Which brings me to introducing Matthew Phillips. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Jason.
How are you?
Great, thanks.
Why don't you tell the listeners a little about yourself?
So I've been a member of St. Paul's for 9 or 10 years.
Okay.
I actually went to divinity school out of college, right after college, and then went to law school and expected that I was going to be a minister, sort of combining those things, standing at the intersection of professions. For a collection of different reasons, that's not the way life went. And so I practiced law for a little while and now teach law and ethics at Wake Forest University and show up around here as often as I possibly can.
Yep.
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool theological nerd.
There we go, which is a good segue to the topic for today.
Nothing like going up against someone who has like a doctorate in making an argument. This is great. I'm looking forward
to
it.
That's good. A little humility won't hurt you, Lucy.
Also, just before we started recording, Lucy's like, I didn't really do much work on this.
Thanks, Jason. It's just that this deep well of knowledge.
It's just already there.
Right. Matthew, you left out another of your relevant talents for this episode. Like, you play the organ. Play the piano.
A little bit, yeah.
I'm in the 9 o'clock choir.
Yeah, I'm not very good at playing any instrument. I am in the 9 o'clock choir. I love singing with the youth and children of this church. And frequent podcast contributor Mark Ardrey Graves is just fantastic to work with. So the one instrument that I professionally played was the carillon, which are the bells in the chapel tower at Wake Forest. And I've played at Duke and a couple of other places too.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Esoteric, nerdy, that's where I live.
Perfect.
Which brings me to today's topic. Today's episode is a real deep dive, I think, but I think it's going to be an interesting one. It was actually suggested by Dr. Mark Ardrey Graves, and I think he's a little upset he wasn't able to be on this episode. But today we are covering the most interesting contributor to the hymnal 1982. The hymnal 1982 is one of the main Episcopal hymnals currently in use in the church today. What can you all tell us just in general about that hymnal?
Take it away, Matthew.
Okay. I guess first you'd want to think about what a hymnal is generally, right? It's an aid for congregational singing that really increased in popularity in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
Okay.
And then the hymnal 1982 comes about after an age where a lot of churches were sort of rejecting the idea of a hymnal. That was when a lot of people moved to song sheets and to more contemporary music. I was talking to someone the other day who remembered singing Bridge Over Troubled Waters in church. A lot of a very different take on music in the church. So I read the other day, and I can't find the citation now, but someone comparing the hymnal to a museum. Hmm. So when you go into a museum, you want to see work from a wide range of times. If you think about the big museums in big cities in the United States or in Europe, right, there's usually some art from antiquity all the way up to their most recent acquisition that may have been painted or sculpted that year. And so you want to see stuff that you haven't thought of that helps you grow in new ways. You want to sometimes open pages and see a work that's been there for a while, but you had kind of forgotten about and never really explored, and you find this new gem. And then I think for my topic, at least, I'll set it up, make it sound like my topic's the natural, better one.
Of course.
You also want to see things that you've seen several times before.
Yeah. Right?
I have been lucky enough to go to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris two or three times, I think. And every time I go straight for Van Gogh's first Starry Night, mm-hmm. which is not the famous one that's on T-shirts. It's an earlier one. And I just love that piece of art. I couldn't go to that museum and not see it,
yeah.
right? And would be horrified if it weren't there. So the Hymnal 1982 is a really concentrated attempt to show lots of ancient liturgical music, as well as some very new work, and a lot in between. Actually, most of the most familiar hymns to us come from 18th, 19th century, sort of in the Protestant church. That's sort of our great golden age of hymnody. So a really broad range there. And I think they do a really good job of that.
Okay, cool.
The name is unfortunate. The Hymnal 1982. It was obsolete 2 months after it was published.
And it's not even the 1982 hymnal, which I hear that used a lot, but it is officially the Hymnal 1982, which just doesn't roll. It doesn't sound great.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also worth noting that we have several other official hymn, like books of music, like Lift Every Voice and Sing, Voices Found.
Yep.
I'm leaving out one of them, and I'm sorry to it. But I think there's another one. So there are others that have, you know, that kind of expand our hymn options. But the Hymnal 1982 is the usually blue hymnal you find in most Episcopal Church pew racks when you sit down.
I specifically asked y'all to look at that hymnal because I'm hoping we can dive into the other ones too at some point in this podcast. But this is a good place to start, I think. Matthew, I think when we were going over, when I asked everybody kind of say which ones were their preferred choices, I think this was like in like your top four or something like that. What made you excited about this topic?
It was one of the few topics where I thought I might be able to speak intelligently for an entire 20 minutes.
Well, there we go. That's a good reason.
That's not stopped any of us before.
Exactly.
It's not a requirement.
Right. I love the hymnal for exactly the reasons I was just saying.
Yeah.
The way in which it is a museum and not in a pejorative sense, right? Yeah. I was actually just talking to Mark about that image, and he mentioned that some people hear that as negative, right? Mm-hmm. I hear it as hugely positive. And it's such a big reason of the, such a big part of the reason I am here in the Episcopal Church in St. Paul's in particular. There's just nothing like the feeling of being in church surrounded by, 300 or 400 people singing from the same page together and trying to worship God with all that all of us have to offer, good singers, bad singers, basses, sopranos, old, young.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that in the Episcopal Church, that usually means there are other people around the world, as well as around Winston-Salem, right, singing the same music, the same words, maybe not exactly the same time, but...
But especially on really big holidays, you know, we're going to sing similar songs.
Right. We're doing something together with a lot of other people.
Yeah.
And I love that.
That's great. Lucy, did you have a hard time making your pick?
No,
I think you got really fast to me. Like, you knew right off the bat what you were going to do.
Well, the first half of the season that we recorded in the fall, I was one of those who was really bad about getting my answers to Jason ahead of time. So this time I was determined. So the day that Jason sent us our schedule, I immediately responded with all my picks. And so I just went with my gut response to each of my topics. And so far that has, I mean, I think that's the best, like, for me, that's the best tactic with these is like the one that I, you know, my immediate answer is usually probably the one I need to go with. So,
So that's exactly what I did, except I changed a week ago.
Well, that will lead to your downfall. And I'm
in each episode, our two guests will present their case. We'll talk a little about it. And after the episode, you listeners get to vote on who told the most compelling story. I'm the only one who knows what story each person is going to tell and who will go first. Until now, Lucy, are you ready to present your case? See, okay, here's, you
Why
know I was going to pick you.
Why do I always have to go
first?
Well,
because you keep pointing to new people and I want them to have a chance.
You don't have to be delicate with Matthew and with Daniel. I love it. Okay, sure. Right. I will go first.
You ready to go tell us the most interesting contributor to the Hymnal 1982?
Yes, I am ready.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, a little bit. Matthew just touched on this, but I just kind of wanted to do a little scene setting.
Okay.
My favorite hymns, I think, and you didn't, this is not the topic, favorite yep. hymn or best hymn, but my favorite hymns, the ones that I find myself most drawn to in the hymnal 1982, are the ones that are about the Eucharist, and specifically the ones that express awe and wonder and mystery about the Eucharist. They tend to be really ancient ones, and they tend to be almost haunting in the tune that goes with them. And I just, for those in the kind of that scene that Matthew was describing of when we are in church together and people are singing together and we're about to do this, this thing that is, even if we do it every day or every week, the Eucharist, it still contains so much mystery and wonder and awe. And music helps us remember that and focus our attention on that, that it's something we don't entirely understand but that, you know, we have this gratitude. So some of my very favorite hymns in the hymnal are Now My Tongue, the Mystery Telling, which was written by Thomas Aquinas, Humbly I Adore Thee, Verity Unseen, also written by Thomas Aquinas. So I could have gone with him, but I didn't think he was the most, I mean, Thomas Aquinas is a great, maybe you, I don't know, this is not your answer, but hopefully. obviously, Thomas Aquinas is a hugely
make the
influential,
Thomas Aquinas fans mad.
Right. Hugely influential theologian. If my theology professor is listening to this one, which I'm pretty sure he doesn't, I just wanted to say that I truly value his work. And I did not go with that one. I went with Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence, which the source, and if you look in our hymnal, it's hymn 324. The source says the Liturgy of St. James. And so this one is really ancient. And so with what Matthew was talking about of like we have a hymn in our hymnal that was written by someone who's been the poet laureate in our country, like in my lifetime. I mean, since I've been an adult, Richard Wilbur wrote, A Stable Lamp Is Lighted. That's a hymn. And I thought about him. He's an incredible poet. But if you kind of go the other end of the spectrum, as far as like this, all the sort of different ages that are included in the hymnal, the Liturgy of St. James would be the other end of that. And it is, so just the hymn is Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence. You may be familiar. It's sung at the Eucharist. It's also sung around Christmas time because there's some imagery around like the birth of Jesus as well. But
I
it
feel
is
like
a,
we needed to do this at an organ or something. And have
I know, and I'm not
okay. Now
we'll
let's
have
pause
to find
and sing the hymn
to yeah. make sure people.
I'm
have
I'm not
going to
sing it because y'all do not want that. But I'll just kind of I won't read all the lyrics. But the first stanza, just to jog your memory, is "Let all mortal flesh keep silence and with fear and trembling stand, ponder nothing earthly minded, for with blessing in His hand, Christ our God to earth descending comes our homage to command." And the last verse, which is just, you know, you get to the end of it and it's just beautiful. At His feet, the six-winged seraph, cherubim with sleepless eye, veil their faces to the presence as with ceaseless voice they cry, Alleluia, 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 Lord Most High. Beautiful.
Beautiful.
So it comes, for sure, was used in the 5th century in the Liturgy of St. James at the presentation of the bread and wine. So when the bread and wine were brought forward in this ancient liturgy, the priest would have been chanting these words. And so this tune that we sing it, that we know from our hymnal, was written by Ralph Vaughan Williams much later, obviously, but the text is from at least the 5th century, maybe the late 4th century. But the really cool part, the thing that I think makes it the most interesting contributor, is that the Liturgy of St. James is attributed to St. James the Less, or St. James Minor, who was one of the 12 apostles. And there's a tradition that he was a brother of Jesus. And he was he's known as the first bishop of Jerusalem. So there's a tradition that he wrote it in the first century.
Oh, wow.
And like, beat that, Matthew, the brother of Jesus. obviously we don't know for sure. I was also talking to Mark R.G. Graves about this before, and he was saying, I think Greek Orthodox, I think that was what he was referring to, but in the Greek Orthodox tradition, that it is like, yes, this was written by St. James of Jerusalem. and that is, you know, a part of the tradition, and it's still used. I looked at the hymnal commentary that's written by or edited by Ray Glover, and he mentioned that it's still used by Syrian Christians in Jerusalem and elsewhere. So it definitely has really ancient roots. I love the idea of these words being chanted, prayed by the priest as the bread and wine are brought forward, because they contain such just awe and mystery. And it, the hymn draws on language from Isaiah 6 and Revelation 5, which are also two of my favorite passages. So here, this is just really, just a lot of good stuff in here. But Isaiah 6 is the one that begins, "In the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And one called to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.'" So hopefully, when you hear that, you can sort of bring to mind our Eucharistic prayer as well. Yeah. We sing, "Holy, holy, holy." We surround, you know, we are around the altar. And Revelation 5 has a similar image. "I've heard the voice of many angels surrounding the throne and the living creatures and the elders. They numbered myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, singing with full voice, 'Worthy is the Lamb that was slaughtered to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing.' Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them singing, 'To the one seated on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever.'" So, like, not only is it an ancient hymn, but it's drawing on these, you know, Isaiah and even more ancient text. And that gets picked up in Revelation as well. And that in itself is embodying what the hymn is saying. That, like, not only are there angels and all these different kinds of angels, but all the generations, you know, saints and angels, and then these, and then whoever's around currently. Like, it's just such a resonant image of, like, what we do believe about the Eucharist is, like, it's not just those of us we can see who are around that table, that altar. Like, there are choirs of angels singing with us and generations that have gone before us and those to come. That's a part of our Eucharistic theology. And it's so good when music can kind of illustrate that for us without us having to, you know, say, "This is what we believe about," you know, stop in the middle and say, like, "Just a reminder, this is what we believe." So music really does something. I mean, it's like poetry, where it can express something that we can't necessarily describe, but it gets at a truth of something that can be hard to describe. And so, I mean, hymns are like poetry set to music. And when you have a hymn like this, where the text is what it is, and then the tune that goes with it just increases that sense of awe and wonder. It's just a really potent part of our worship. Let me see if there's anything else I wanted to.
I do. I really agree with you that that has got to be one of the most transcendent, text and tune combinations, and makes it really, so my daughter says that's her favorite hymn.
Oh, wow.
So I win.
So from, you know, she didn't say it was the most interesting contributor. Well, she said it's her favorite hymn. So from, you know, earlier than 10 years old, she said that, up to,
wow,
I love that.
You know, who knows?
Yeah, kids get it.
How old people are in there. It's a very accessible hymn. It, like, helps you figure out how important it is because of the way it sounds and comes
across.
It's
like across. You hear that tune and you're like, oh, something important is happening. And it is. And I just love that it's been chanted or sung for, you know, as many centuries as it has,
possibly back to the apostles.
Christians all over the world. I mean, from Jerusalem to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, across all that time. And it wasn't translated into English until, well, Mark told me that, okay, I don't want to get in the weeds. It wasn't translated into English till much later. At the latest, the 1800s, the 18th century, I think, but then possibly earlier. So, I don't want to get too in the weeds, but we can, if you are interested, ask Mark Ardrey Graves.
Yeah.
He's really pulling the strings.
Yeah, seriously. He's in this episode, even if he didn't get to be one of the, yeah. yeah, I think that's my stuff.
Awesome. Thank you, Lucy.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I really like the museum metaphor. And that really helps me think about that sort of spectrum. And so it was cool to think of, I mean, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but part of it is the fact that this is like so foundational. This goes all the way back.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why it's such an interesting contribution to the hymnal.
Yeah. Yeah. Like possibly one of the apostle, right. You know, the original 12, but at latest, late 4th, early 5th century liturgy that was used in Jerusalem.
Interesting. Thank you, Lucy.
At the source.
Right, at the source.
What is more interesting than that?
Matthew, did you consider this pick when you were looking at your options?
No, I think, so if the question had been, like, if you could have one hymn on a desert island...
oh, that's a good question.
Then she mentioned,
nerdy, but that's a good question.
Yeah, only one thing you can sing forever. Then two that you mentioned, Lucy, Adoro Te Devote, the Humbly I Adore Thee, and this one would be top contenders for me. But no, I didn't think about it primarily because I was trying to separate contributor from the hymn contributed.
Okay. And you mentioned that you changed your pick.
Yeah.
Why? What made you want to change it?
Well, to be totally honest, you know, just between us, my first pick was Charles Wesley.
Just between us and everyone listening to the podcast.
Yeah, I realized that was silly. My first pick was Charles Wesley.
Yeah.
And I'm conscious of being a Methodist convert to the Episcopal Church, and so kind of was uneasy about bringing along perhaps the best thing the Methodist Church contributed to the Protestant Church, which is Charles Wesley and his identity. I'll still talk about him a little bit, but
fine.
I kind of picked another contributor.
Okay, you ready to tell us your pick?
Yeah. So this, I mean, I feel for people who have to vote between these two because there's not a lot of parallelism between them.
No, that's good though.
Well, no, it's not, because what's going to happen is they're not going to be able to compare the two, and so they're just going to vote for Lucy because she's so much more likable than I am.
No,
but that's okay. So yeah, I thought about Wesley, who contributed 20 texts to our hymnal.
Wow.
I'm not sure he's the heaviest contributor, but he's really close. But then I decided I kind of liked this, like how much a person impacted the book, and so I decided to go really big.
Okay.
If you open your hymnal and look at the bottom of a hymn, you'll see the text author's name and dates or the date when it was written. And then many times you'll see ALT, those three letters, at the end of the line, which means the text has been altered. Usually by the editors of the hymnal 1982. Sometimes the alteration happened earlier. And so it turns out this is the most prolific contributor. I'm putting air quotes, listeners, around contributor. Something like 40% of the hymn texts in the hymnal 1982 have been edited by Alt. And the fact that you often
that is your answer?
Who Alt is.
Is Alt?
Yeah, it's Alt.
Oh, my God. Okay, that is hard to vote between.
Right. Yeah, it's totally different. But easily the biggest contributor, right? If you think of Alt as a person. And the fact that we don't know who exactly Alt is on any given hymn actually makes it that much more interesting.
Yeah,
Sometimes we can trace it. A lot of times we can't.
Guys, I can't stop laughing.
That's okay. You just sit over there and laugh while you think about what it's going to feel like to lose. So actually, even the 40% is not exact because there are so many, it's hard to count.
Okay.
I started flipping through the hymnal. Thought I was going to do this like old school. I was just going to add them up. And I got tired after I got to 100. A computer search suggests the number may even be higher than 40% of the hymns in the hymnal.
Okay.
And so it's a huge number have been altered.
Is there never, if it is altered, do they ever put the name of the person who altered it? Or
not in the hymnal.
Okay.
So in the companion that Lucy mentioned before, there are individual articles about each hymn, and some of those explain, and I'll talk a little bit about some specific alterations, but often it was done by committee. As the 1982 hymnal was being produced.
As the Episcopalians like to do.
Yeah, exactly. We can figure out who was in the room, but we don't know who said, I can't stand that word, or this image is confusing, or whatever. So the number in our hymnal is big in part because the Standing Commission on Church Music, which ordered, like said, okay, let's go do the hymnal in 1982, was very meticulous in documenting every change. So there are a lot of hymnals that if you open them up, it wouldn't say altered or adapted or anything, but the words have been. Mm. One or two words would get changed editorially or for inclusive language or some other reason, and they just don't mention it because it was such a minor change. We put alt if anything was altered from the original work of the author.
Wow.
So that's part of why it looks like such a big deal in our hymnal. If you compare to the United Methodist hymnal, I said I wasn't going to be the Methodist convert, but actually it's a pretty good comparison because it's a relatively similar theological tradition. And the United Methodist hymnal was written 7 years after ours. So similar history, time period, and everything. We have dramatically more alterations. Mm. So it's not just about sort of time and history. So some of those changes are really mild. Mild's a tough word because I'm about to do whatever. Isaac Watts's Joy to the World, which is like maybe the most popular hymn in a pew today anywhere in America, includes the phrase, let men their songs employ. And like almost every other modern hymnal, the hymnal 1982 changes that to let us our songs employ. Mm. So there actually is a little theological loss there, right? Mm-hmm. Watts was trying to make the point that humankind sings of the new king and nature echoes. So later on in the hymn, he writes, nature repeats the sounding joy, right? The sounding joy comes from people.
Yeah.
And that was really important to Watts. He was trying to explain something about who recognizes Christ first and what the response of nature is. So, you know, there's a little loss there. When you say, let us our songs employ, you lose the kind of back and forth of that. But in a cost-benefit analysis, that feels pretty good because if we communicated that only men do or should sing of Jesus' coming, that would be a much bigger theological loss.
Right?
I mean, just fallacious and also exclusive, excluding in a way that we wouldn't want to do. But there are some much more significant changes. In some hymns, whole phrases move, verses get reordered or deleted, and sometimes the poetry gets like really ruined with just pedestrian language. So a couple of examples. First, let me sort of talk about the two main drivers. Like, why do we change texts at all? The first one, as I said with Joy to the World, is inclusion. That's by far the most common reason. And that's something that was really not a concern in Episcopal hymnody until hymnal 1982. There were a couple of in-between after the 1940 hymnal was the previous sort of major hymnal. And this was not really a concern. People just weren't thinking about it that much in 1940. This is sort of the biggest reason anyone's ever needed to revise hymns. And every other tradition is doing it too. We're not alone in this. And that was a specific stated purpose for the Standing Commission. They said the text of the hymnal should, wherever possible, use inclusive language which affirms the participation of all in the body of Christ, the church, while recognizing our diverse natures as children of God. So great. We don't want anyone ever to be in a pew and feel like, oh, I walked in the wrong place. This is not for me.
Yeah.
Right. Beyond a number of examples where a masculine term has changed, there are other efforts at inclusivity too. So I'll confess that one that drives me crazy, mostly because I have the unaltered hymn memorized, is O for a Thousand Tongues to Sing, which is number 493 in our hymnal. And it is a Charles Wesley hymn, by the way. I think it's the fourth verse of that tune or that hymn is hear him, ye deaf, his praise, ye dumb, your loosened tongues employ. And that becomes hear him, ye deaf, ye voiceless ones, your loosened tongues employ. Mm. So I think this is kind of an interesting dive into the decision process that's going on. So we don't use dumb as a term to describe people who are mute any longer.
Right.
And so you'd be concerned because of the way dumb does get used in our culture that would make people with disabilities feel excluded. On the other hand, we don't say employ a whole lot, and we rarely use ye as the second-person pronoun. So there are a lot of cues that the language is different than this hymn, and we might want to think about that. I don't think anyone would read this and think, oh, well, all the other text in this hymn is exactly the way I normally use it. So that must mean, you know, I think it's pretty obvious. You have to do a little bit of translation into contemporary language there. I think probably more problematic when in for this priority of inclusion and less explicit are the ways that hymns are uninclusive, like equating purity with whiteness, which is a problem in a lot of hymns, not just American hymns, but a lot of hymnody. And the editors mentioned that they tried to minimize that in the hymnal 1982. So it's not just gendered language, although that's usually the first thing we think about. There are a lot of other kinds of inclusivity that the editors were worried about. The other, and I've already sort of hinted at this, is contemporary usage. So the editors say that language that is obscure or so changed in contemporary usage as to have different meanings should be clarified. Exceptions to this will be those classic texts which are firmly established in the worship of the church and are deeply rooted in the spiritual life of its people. So as an example of this, there's a hymn by Cecil Francis Alexander, who, by the way, is the second most interesting. So not only did you lose, you're at third at best, Lucy.
Argue with the brother of Jesus. It's
that's
fine.
Right. That's right. It wouldn't be the first time. So she has this hymn called There is a Green Hill Far Away. It's number 167 in the hymnal. And right after the title, right, she writes, there is a green hill far away without a city wall. And in the hymnal 1982, that text is changed to there is a green hill far away outside a city wall. Well, that's a contemporary usage change, right? That she was not trying to say there is a hill that doesn't have a wall around it. She was trying to say there is a hill, outside a city where Christ was crucified, right? And so if you don't know that without means outside of in her 19th century language, then you are missing something about that hymn, right? Mm-hmm. So 1982 changes that. Yeah, changes that so you can see that she's talking about the hill where Jesus was crucified. There are a fair number of examples, where the hymn gets changed for multiple reasons. It kind of seems like once Alt gets started, Alt doesn't know when to stop.
This is relevant in the AI talks. That
yeah,
are
exactly
going on
right.
Yeah.
Like if we let ChatGPT write a hymn, what would it do? So next I want to talk about Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which I think is some of Alt's most condescending work. This is really about how dumb modern listeners are. So Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing is an 18th century hymn written by British writer Robert Robinson. And it's got this, a lot of us, I don't know about you, Lucy, I think a lot of people sort of our age group might have sung this at youth or on a retreat in the mountains or at the beach or something like that. You can definitely do this to a guitar. And so it has a kind of casual feeling, and it has these wonderful images of mountains and water and a lot of sort of youth retreat kind of
things.
I think
Sufjan Stevens even did a banjo version, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, it's a very adaptable and well-loved hymn. So it conjures all these retreat kind of things for me where you're often actually in the mountains while you sing it or by a stream or something. So it all these swirling images of water and mountain and heaven itself are really kind of cool. So Alt actually has a really long track record with this hymn. It first appeared in the 1826 hymnal with the opening, Savior, Source of Every Blessing. So totally different opening words, right? You wouldn't even recognize it. The words were changed back to Robinson's text in the 1940 hymnal. So it lived with different words for a long time, and we sort of unalted it. The second verse of the original hymn, where we make, I think, the change that bothers me the most in the whole hymnal, the second verse of the original hymn is, Here I raise mine Ebenezer, hither by thy help I'm come. And in 1982, it's altered to, Here I find my greatest treasure, hither by thy help I've come. So there are two big changes. By thy help, I'm come changes to by thy help, I've come. I think by thy help, I'm come is kind of charming and not really in need of a grammar fix from the brilliant minds of 1865, which is when that was first changed.
Interesting.
But, no great sin, right? The other major change is that Ebenezer gets edited out.
Yeah.
Because, of course, none of us know what Ebenezer means and wouldn't have any idea how to use a dictionary to learn, right? How would you ever, if you could enter that on a computer and get results, maybe that would be nice. But since that's not possible.
I'm detecting some sarcasm.
Someone has got
to. I don't know if you can feel it in the room.
Yeah,
but.
No, that's shocking, right? So clearly someone has to save us from our own ignorance. So Ebenezer gets changed presumably because it's not familiar language, right? Yeah. And there was a rule for the hymnal that we want contemporary usage whenever possible. But that's its own problem because Ebenezer is scriptural. Hmm. So if we don't know Ebenezer, that means we don't know 1 Samuel as well as we might like to. It comes from 1 Samuel 7:12, when Samuel sets up a stone to commemorate the ways in which God helped the Israelites against the Philistines. So it means stone of help. Hmm. It's like a little monument to the work that God had done to help the Israelites there. So if you think about the mountaintop experiences that so many of us have during our lives of faith, I think it's pretty easy to sympathize with Samuel and draw an important lesson, right? We acknowledge God's help and our closeness to God up at this mountaintop moment, at the highlights and the soaring moments of our faith. But we have to remember that stone and the faith that it represents when we're living everyday lives that aren't quite so ideal. So that scriptural image through Ebenezer is actually a big help.
Yeah, I think also what bothers me about that, too, is you've taken away the opportunity to discover and learn. The opportunity to be like, well, why does it say Ebenezer? Is this a Christmas carol or what's happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Then, this is about Scrooge.
You
what's
can see
up?
Like a little kid singing that song wanting to know why it's there. And then there you lose that opportunity.
Yes, kind of that little child's education died a bit the day that the hymnal committee changed it. Right. So, and the replacement is just bad. Yeah. Here I find my greatest treasure is sloppy language, first of all, and maybe even bad theology, because it suggests that our greatest treasure is away from our normal lives up on some mountain. Mm. Mm. But God's kingdom is everywhere and certainly isn't limited to mountaintops. And so the altered text supports this kind of one day we'll get to heaven and everything will be okay sort of theology that misses the point of our work on earth. Mm. At the end of the first verse of the original, the text says, "Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love." But the 1982 hymnal changes it to "Praise the mount, O fix me on it, mount of God's unchanging love." That's just gratuitous. There's not gendered language there. There's not sort of archaic language. It's just an editorial. This is what I meant. Like, I think once alt gets started, like, never knows quite when to stop. I think the better theological point is the original, that I'm fixed upon it. That implies God does important work with us when we meet God on a mountain. Whereas alt suggests we get permanently stuck with God, like you've fixed me here, I can't move. And the change from thy redeeming love to God's unchanging love is similarly pointless. It doesn't make the language more inclusive or accessible. It just loses the point that God's love has a purpose, redemption. Mm. So the other one I wanted to mention is Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Are you going to get to when they decide or didn't decide to change? Like, my favorite, the thing that makes me laugh in church when we're singing is when a hymn would clearly rhyme if we were singing the way that, like, the choir, the boys' choir at, like, King's College Cambridge would sing, or at Westminster Abbey would sing. Like, sure. if you sing in that accent, the words at the end of the line rhyme.
Yeah.
But if you're singing in, you know, just how we sing in North Carolina, like, blood and rude, it's like, well, and maybe in, you know, that style, why doesn't alt care about that?
I don't know. Sometimes alt does change that. So in Hark the Herald Angels Sing, there are some sort of Charles Wesley rhymes that you need a British accent to work that get edited out, but I don't think that's why they get edited out. So, like, rhyme, I mean,
it just makes me chuckles. It's like, I start singing in a British accent so that it will rhyme.
You're probably not the only Episcopalian either.
Right, exactly. You wouldn't be the only Episcopalian affecting the British accent if you did that either. So interestingly, the hymnal committee does not seem to think that rhyming is a goal they need to pursue.
Mm. Which is interesting when you think about the person who was composing it. Clearly,
did intend for
it
to rhyme.
If they made it happen, it was clearly important. I mean, that's not easy to do always.
Right. So I guess the sort of contemporary language issue, if that's important, then so is adapting
the
language
of the
so
poet.
That the rhyme works, right? Yeah. Yeah. So why do we do one thing and not the other, I think, is kind of hard to explain.
Right. Alt has some explaining to do.
Yeah, alt has some explaining to do. And it's often not, I mean, again, you don't know usually who alt is or when alt worked.
Yeah, that is.
Could have been in the 1940 hymnal, could have been in the 1826 hymnal, or it could have been in the 1982 hymnal. So Hark the Herald Angels Sing is interesting because we unalted it a little bit and then re-alted it in a different way. It's among the most widely sung Christmas carols, of course, frequently in the service of nine lessons and carols, and almost always on Christmas Eve. So almost nobody sings the hymnal 1982 version and thinks, oh, that sounds right to me. Because if you're a Cradle Episcopalian, then you probably have heard the Wesley text used in concerts or over the radio from King's College or something like that, right? Brits do not sing our version of it. They sing something closer to the original Wesley text. If you converted from another tradition, you almost definitely grew up singing a slightly altered, but not altered as much as ours version. So a lot of hymnals change a couple of words to eliminate a particularly overt use of masculine pronouns in this hymn. We can talk a little bit more about that. So Wesley's hymn actually opened, when he wrote it, it opened, "Hark, how all the," excuse me, this is hard to say. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is why we needed it. "Hark, how all the welkin rings." But George Whitfield.
The what now? The welkin?
The welkin. Oh. See, I thought you would know that.
I don't know that word.
We should poll people in the building and see. So Anglican cleric and British Methodist George Whitfield changed the line in 1753 because he didn't think enough people knew the old Saxon word welkin, which means vault of heaven. So it's like Ebenezer, right?
Right.
I mean, George Whitfield decided in 1753 that the people around him were too dumb to know what welkin meant, and so I lost the chance to find out. It kind of bugs me.
And you can't stick vault of heaven in replace.
Right. Vault of heaven's way too many syllables.
Saxon? Where did you say it was from?
Saxon.
Saxon?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the original words inspired this kind of cool thought, right? Hark, how all the welkin rings. Imagine singing that. I mean, first of all, you have to imagine that you know what the word means.
Right.
And then imagine singing it in the nave, right, with these huge vaulted ceilings over you. And imagine what we're saying is, this not only this whole church, but this whole vaulted world is singing with us. Mm. And I know what that means. I'm not quite sure what a herald angel is, right? I mean, I get it, but I can't visualize it as well.
Mm.
The first two verses are familiar and pretty close to the Wesley text. It's in the third verse where alt goes off the rails. So Wesley's poem and most renditions start the third verse, "Hail the heaven-born Prince of Peace, hail the Son of Righteousness. Mild he lays his glory by, born that man no more may die. Born to raise the sons of earth, born to give them second birth." So heavy masculine language there, right? So you can imagine there's some inclusivity problems. Several other hymnals address some of that. Our hymnal starts in the middle of the verse, which is a curious beginning to this triumphant hymn. Often we have trumpets playing with us when we sing this. And the third verse, usually the one where the organ swells into its wild and crazy accompaniment, starts, "Mild he lays his glory by, born that we no more may die." Mm. Mild he lays his glory. But we've got trumpets and drums and the organ's at full voice. And this is a place where changing gendered language may actually be a problem, right? Some of it makes sense to change, but there's a theological point being made about Christ as the second Adam, which is really obvious if you read the rest of Wesley's poem beyond these three verses. And a bit of fun with son, as in of a father, and sun, as in the sky.
Yeah.
And that all gets obscured, right? We lose that in our version. So, okay, I'm describing alt as a problem. I think it's a fascinating aspect to our hymnal, and it's something kind of distinctive. But so is it a problem? Like, who really cares? Well, first of all, it's a podcast, and so I'm pretty sure the rule is if I care, I get to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
but seriously, so first, hymnals support living worship, but they're also historical documents. And so I know what Ebenezer means because there was a footnote on some version of "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing" I sang growing up. And I know that "without" can mean outside because I learned Cecil Frances Alexander's hymn when I was a kid. So it's good to have to stretch occasionally, as you were saying, Jason, right? And there are plenty of opportunities. Like, we have an awesome director of communication at St. Paul's who could definitely help people figure out in the middle of a service, what did that hymn mean sang, right? I mean, plenty of opportunities. Let's learn something while we're here. Second, hymnals should connect us to the communion of saints. Lucy mentioned this earlier, right? If we put everything in contemporary language that fits our context, then we break what I would call vertical communion with all the people who have come before us. Hmm. And we're inviting a break with all the people who come after. Because if I can't preserve 18th century language, why would I expect that anyone else is going to preserve 21st century language? Hmm. So I'm not singing the same words that my great-great-grandparents parents sing or that my great-great-grandchildren would sing. And it actually bothers me more that we're breaking horizontal communion, right, with people all around the world right now. Hymns are one of the few things we share, I mentioned before. And so I really like the idea of singing the same words that are being sung around the world and around Winston-Salem. And you lose that if you, especially if you do things as profound as changing verse orders and big phrases. But, and I really want to highlight this, you should not have to sing words that exclude or oppress you. Mm-hmm. Right? We need to do some alt kind of work mm-hmm. because of what we've inherited. I'm not opposed right. to all alterations. Yeah. If there are masculine terms that are used to make a theological point, I think we need to take that seriously. Right? Yeah. Hark, the Herald Angels Sing has some of those examples. But if there are masculine terms used because the hymn writer hadn't imagined women as leaders or faithful or driving important change, then that's a problem. We need to fix that,
right?
But I don't think that means every masculine pronoun needs to change. At the end of the day, love it or hate it, alt is a distinctive feature of the hymnal 1982, and the hundreds of stories behind each time that those letters appear at the bottom of the hymn make it the most interesting contributor.
That is interesting.
I love that we're both kind of the worst and didn't. Like, probably when you asked this question, Jason, you were like please pick, you know, Charles Wesley or, you know, Christina Rossetti or some, you know, please pick a person.
Phillips Brooks.
But I appreciate that both of you took an interesting spin on it. I was actually just, I had an interaction with alt once in my professional career as a church communicator because at my previous parish, every Easter, the parish absolutely has to hear I'm the Bread of Life, which is based on like Gospel John.
So let me just say, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jason. That is my guilty pleasure.
Is it?
Yes.
So my previous parish that I worked at had to be sung on Easter, had to raise them up. It was a big thing. And there are some theological issues with the language and in the 1982 hymnal. And then I remember one Easter, one of the clergy where I worked had said, let's just take this verse out. We'll just take this verse out. This one, that's all. You would have thought that they were going to come with pitchforks and torches because we did that Easter. It was scary how upset they were. So then the next year that clergy person was like, okay, we're just going to change these two words in that verse. Again, furious.
Wow.
I mean, even people who you would think might even have the same theological issues with the language for that particular verse. But it did remind me of sort of the real value or the real weight that is in the hymnal as part of our faith. And it's interesting to think about alt and what implications and impacts that can have. So that was good.
Yeah, and it creates all these questions around communication, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we were to, for example, change the verse order of Hark, the Herald Angels Sing back to the sort of standard, still commonly used in Britain version, then I bet there are enough people in the church, because 1940 had the weird ordering too, right? So cradle Episcopalians may think that's the way it's supposed to sound.
Yeah.
And educating about why we had changed it if we did would be hard.
Right. And I think both the stories really sort of highlight that the just the significance that there's these things that are so old that they are still so important that they get preserved and moved on through these different hymnals and different faiths, really, or different faith religious faiths. But there's just so much value into that little book that it's I think both of your stories really spoke to that. So thank you.
Yeah, it's such a timely, I mean, especially Matthew's answer, such a timely topic that I feel like is extending to everything right now, of like just looking at what we use, what we say, what we believe. And, you know, we don't necessarily have to have an all or nothing. Everything old is bad or everything old is good. And you can find people who feel strongly in, you know, about both of those positions, but to have a more sort of discerning, it takes more work. It's more complicated. It's more time consuming to say, you know, at what point do we say, okay, we don't want to use this anymore. We don't want to repeat this. And at what point do we say this, we think this is important enough. The tradition here is, you know, has had enough of an impact that we want to edit this and keep using it. And I mean, that's hard work. And, but it's also important work for all the reasons you said, Matthew, like we can't just whole cloth, bring everything, but also what do we lose? What treasure do we lose if we just say, no, we're only going to sing hymns written after you know, 1970 right. or
something. Well, and interestingly, too, it was, what, 40 years between the 82 and the, mm-hmm. the previous hymnal. So, I mean, we're at that mark now. I'd be curious to see, like, what in the Episcopal Church is being done about, you know, sort of a new hymnal, mm-hmm. if there's energy behind that, if people are talking yeah. about that now.
There's definitely things now that I cringe, I mean, I just cringe, that are cringy and, yeah. and not, you know, I don't think if we were to put it together now, we would include or we would alt it. And yeah, I actually don't know. I mean, we talk yeah. so much about prayer book revision. I don't know much about, yeah, that would be, again, a mark. Archie sure Graves or John Cummins question.
Mark's like perked up somewhere right now. Yeah. Just like, I need to
talk about
it.
You're
going
to have like a little addendum onto this episode for
we
Mark.
Need some Mark commentary. Yeah,
a supplementary for subscribers.
Well, one of my fears is that what we end up doing is through the sort of extra hymn sources, we end up, there are a couple of different ways you could see this, right? We end up sort of band-aiding the hymnal by having extra resources to sing from. And we don't use those a lot at St. Paul's, but a lot of other Episcopal congregations do. And the problem with that to me is if we're all using different stuff, that was one of the things I loved about the mm. hymnal that's gone, mm-hmm. right? So I hope we will, when the time is right, revise the hymnal and have the hymnal.
Yeah, mm. include more of the resources that are now considered supplementary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, to have more voices. Yeah, for sure. I would like to see that too.
Although on the other hand, right, we learn through those supplements sometimes that some of this music doesn't age very well.
Mm. Right.
Right. And so it's kind of nice to have a way to experiment with some other yeah. things and decide, do we want to print this into a book we're going to use for 40 years?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, editing for our 2023 understanding is such a tricky thing because, it, mm-hmm. you know, in 2 years from now, we might be like, oh, that was a mistake. You
right.
know, we
mm-hmm.
didn't, we thought we were being wise and thoughtful and actually we were, you know, pretty ignorant in that. And yeah, it's just, yeah. it's a constantly evolving thing. So it needs to be a constantly evolving source. But some things last for centuries, like the Liturgy of St. James.
That's right.
Matthew, Lucy, thank you for being on the show.
Absolutely.
This was definitely not a boring subject at all to me, so I hope it wasn't either for the listeners.
It's a podcast. We get to do whatever we want.
That's true. Exactly. Friends, the cases have been presented, and now the power is in your hands. If you're listening on Spotify, there's a link to a poll in the episode description. Let us know who you think told the most compelling story. Voting for all episodes will remain open until we finish season one, after which we will announce the champions of our inaugural season. We continue to release new episodes each week, so be sure and check often wherever you're listening to your podcasts. Please like and subscribe if you want to hear more. Thanks again, Lucy and Matt. I just looked at the opposite person as I said that, which was weird.
Matt.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you again soon. Bye.
Thanks, Jason.
Bye.